Hello and welcome back to the Palace Way podcast. I am your host, Pat, joined with me with a little solo adventure today, just a one-on-one with my co-host, Bruno. Bruno, how are we doing tonight?
I'm doing absolutely fantastic, mate. Been a good week for Crystal Palace, been a good week for me personally, and I'm looking forward to seeing how we do against Fulham at the weekend as well, although they've just had a brilliant result against Brentford, so hopefully they don't carry too much momentum with them.
That's true. And despite the cards not falling fully in our favor away to Wolves on the weekend, Palace still did leave with a point without Aberry Eze and 4 points if you go back to our match against Tottenham. As I said earlier, if you offered me 4 points against those two clubs, I would have taken it in a heartbeat. I wouldn't have guessed it was the way that it happened. I would have thought the results would have been flipped, but I'm going to take it either way. Before we get into our league play and our league performances, let's talk about that cup tie that we had midweek against Aston Villa, which saw Palace advance to the quarterfinals for the first time in just over a decade. Bruno, what were your thoughts on that?
I thought it was, on the whole, a pretty good performance. My concern after we play well is always how are we going to play in the next game, because our best press tends to tire us out. We saw that last season with our great home performance against Newcastle, followed by a slightly more tired performance against Fulham away, just due to the sheer amount of football we were playing. And I think you could kind of see we're a bit more tired against Villa. Perhaps that was one of the reasons behind the hamstring injury to Eze and the groin pain to Adam Wharton that led to him basically immediately getting surgery afterwards, which has apparently gone well. We played the same but at a less intensity than I think we did at Spurs. I think you've got to make adjustments for a strong Villa side, the fact we were away from home, the fact we were midweek. On the whole, though, it's a victory away against one of the best teams in the country right now. I can't complain too much. There were times where it looked quite bleak, but we started the game really, really strongly. We dropped off for a bit. Daichi Kamada didn't have the best of first halves, but then he ended up being the guy to turn it all around. We clung on, mostly due to the strength of that back three, which has been pretty impeccable since it's gelled. It has its weaknesses, but I don't think that's due to the players as much as the system around it, but we'll get onto that later as well.
Yeah, and I think it's important a couple things when we look at that match. Number one, that side that we saw against Aston Villa, it was a deep squad. It was still a strong side. I think the majority of those guys could be walking into Crystal Palace's 11. If not, they'd be certainly competing for some spots. And that being said, having two injuries in the first 30 minutes, it's certainly going to change your mentality. It's certainly going to change your side. We definitely dropped off, but I would be hard-pressed to find any squad that would not drop off a little bit in their mentality in the way they played after having two major injuries. As you said, could it have been an overuse? Usually hamstrings are. Could that have been avoided? Possibly, but I quite rate our managers going for it in these cups and trying to get a trophy. With Wharton, I've been calling as a sports hernia for the past 2 weeks. I was confirmed that it was a sports hernia. You cannot make a sports hernia worse. It's only about how hard can you play through it? How tough are you? Wharton certainly showed that he's a very, very tough player, because that's an extremely painful injury to deal with. But it's not something where if we push it too far, it's going to make it worse or aggravate it or anything. So I have no issue with him starting that match and having the performance that he did for the first 30. And I also don't blame him one bit for taking himself off, because trust me, any lower abdominal groin thing, it's just wildly, wildly painful. So glad his surgery went well, and glad to see that he'll be back on the mend for us soon.
I guess with Eze coming off so early and Wharton as well, it kind of took that seam out of us, like you said. And it felt like that carried on until Wolves, but I don't think that was mental as much as it was just the absence of a creator in our team. You know, Nketiah and Sarr had really poor games, and then we had to adapt just due to the sheer lack of numbers in our squad, and Glasner's solution was playing Jeffrey Schlupp, a natural left back at left attacking mid, and Daniel Munoz, a right back at right attacking mid. And that's down to the sort of sheer absence of quality in our squad at the moment due to injuries. We're missing Franco, we're missing Eze. Sarr and Nketiah don't seem fully capable of being the players that they were bought to be in those positions. I'm still a bit confused about those transfers because they're not quite clicking yet. I mean, obviously, Sarr was fantastic against Spurs, but he was fantastic in sort of the impact that his attributes had on the rest of the team more so than any individual brilliance. And like that is an asset for sure, but we also need players who are going to win us games in the absence of, well, previously Elise and now Elise and Eze. And we seem to be missing that kind of player.
And you're absolutely right about Sarr. It's more about the presence of what he threatens than what he's actually doing. On its surface, he really hasn't done much for us, but he does offer that pace. He does offer that ability to get wide, to touch. And Munoz is just such an intelligent footballer that he really reads that and is able to kind of underlap and get into the half space himself, where he has shown some creativity. His crossing has been better this season. He is putting some balls into the box. And now that we have more firing and maybe a little more fit Mateta back, he's starting to have somebody to have those crosses land to and create some goals for it. But you're absolutely right that we're lacking that creative impetus, that creative role against Wolves. And in fact, our XG, our chances created for layman's terms, was less than Wolves was for that match from open play. We dominated XG by over more than one. I think it was 2.5 to 1.3, something like that. But half of our XG created was off of set pieces. And that is something that Wolves really struggles with. And it was great to see that Glasner really tried to attack that and focus on that, especially with the lack of a creative person from open play. But it still was something that we were lacking. And it was something that maybe we struggled to kill the game off because we didn't have that creator and we didn't have that open play kind of threat that we normally would with an Eze on the pitch.
Yeah, and that kind of gets reflected in the goals that we conceded, which honestly stemmed from counterattacks of our own. Gueye made an overlapping run, and Nketiah couldn't make the pass to find him. And another one, I think the first goal was Kamada getting dispossessed as well in an attack. So both goals were, yet again, that kind of counterattack goal we've seen work against us so often this season. And I wonder sometimes if that's related to our wing backs at the same time, which we'll get into.
Yeah, that goal with Nketiah not being able to pick out a pass properly, carbon copy of the goal we conceded at Aston Villa in the cup tie away. He really underhit the pass to Kamada, and that kind of led to that goal going in. Just a series of unfortunate events that started after that. So it does go to show that Nketiah, I think he's a final ball finisher. I don't think he's someone that's going to be able to drop back and really start these types of runs, start these attacks. And similar to the Kamada issue that we had earlier in the season, which we're definitely going to get into in a little bit here. I do feel a little bad for Nketiah because I think he's not being played in the position where he has his strengths. I think he's a inside the box striker. I think he's a poacher type. And to get him on the half spaces and kind of have him create a little bit is just a little unfair. So I hope that we can see that and not just, slander the player. But in terms of those goals, yeah. The first one, I believe, was one where Chalobah just seemed to make a very unnecessary, risky challenge aerial to try and stop the ball. And he just kind of, the domino effect from there, it led one thing out to another, and the goal went in. That second goal, it was Kamada with a weak challenge. And Kamada and Mitchell just did not do a great job of tracking back. Mitchell was damn near walking at one point. And, the ball went into the channel there. The ball came across. Our center backs didn't seem to really have much communication with each other. Our center mids weren't really in the right position. And it was just a calamity of errors. I did make a point on the weekend, and it wasn't to absolve Kamada of any wrongdoing on that goal, but I still believe that if you go back and watch that video, there's really not one person you can find fault with. I kind of think Mitchell's effort wasn't great, but the kid's been running up and down the left flank for us for what, 4 years? I mean, he hasn't had a player to spell him for how long? I give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt there, but I don't think it was one person's fault. I don't think that it was one issue. I think it was just, as you said, we got caught on the counter a little bit, and we've seen that happen so many times with us this season, and unfortunately, it happened again.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's in the case of like lacking the players and not having that creativity, that is kind of responsible for us losing the ball in the first place. But I'd argue if we sort of zoom out a bit, and this is something that I'm depressed to be talking about again, you can kind of pitch those goals on poor recruitment in the summer, in terms of not having those players first and foremost, but also not having backups for the players that are too tired to track back. Poor Daniel Munoz, poor Tyrick Mitchell, you know, the pressure is on them to be the key creators in our system when we don't have players like Eze, because that's where the most space is going to be found out wide. They are capable on their best day of producing a good cross, as we've seen, especially from Daniel Munoz recently, but also from Tyrick Mitchell. But in midweek games or in games where they've played many in sort of quick succession, they don't have that energy that is otherwise their sort of standout quality, the difference maker for them. You know, Munoz's whole thing is being the first in 50-50s. Tyrick Mitchell's whole thing is winning every defensive duel, and he does that. But on his best day, he's got the energy to run up the pitch and provide good crosses. I don't think any of his crosses found a man against Wolves. It was constantly intercepted by the first defender in front of him. Because when you're that exhausted, you can't, like after bombing up the pitch, that is, you can't put in a cross of good quality. So to circle back to the sort of transfer criticism, if we'd had a left wing back backup, as we know we wanted so desperately in the summer, and yet turned down Ryan Sessegnon, which I think was a valid thing, you know, he's not even playing for Fulham now. But it was clearly a position we wanted. We didn't invest, and we're seeing the consequences there. This kind of segues me on to the next thing I wanted to pitch to you, which I wrote an article about earlier this week. I don't know if you read it, but after the Wolves game, I wanted to talk about the way we've treated our youth academy this season, which is to say a lot more as a kind of hypocritical excuse than anything else. Strong words, I'll justify it. When we didn't sign a left wing back, the first thing that Oliver Glasner said was about the promise of Franco Umeh as a backup player. This was reported by Alan Nixon originally in pre-season. He spoke about it before the end of the window as well, Glasner, in a press conference. Then afterwards, he spoke about Franco's ability to deputise for Tyrick Mitchell. Franco Umeh has yet to play this season. So is he really good enough to deputise, or are we just using the academy as a fullback for us not signing someone? Let's try that again with someone else. How about not signing a right back? We've got Nathaniel Clyne who can cover at wing back, but realistically, he's not as good in that role as he is now as a right-sided centre back, where he excelled last season under Glasner. We've got Caleb Cupora on the bench, another one of our youth products, but he's 5'5" and only just starting out playing under 21s football. I wouldn't dream of recommending throwing him in. But he was another one of the youth players named on the bench because we didn't sign anyone else in that position. Same applies to Ashraq Benone, who was the only forward we had available on our bench, if you don't count Jeffrey Schlupp, which I don't, considering he's played as a midfielder and a defender for the predominant majority of his career, apart from the times that he's been called by sheer desperation of managers into the forward line. Palace fans will remember him at striker against Newcastle in 2021. That was not a fun day. But we've got these players on our bench that Glasner has gone out and said, you know, we will trust them. We do trust them. We will rely on them when we need them. And I couldn't make a stronger case for needing them than the way our attack has looked in some cases, or the way that Tyrick Mitchell's fitness has been. We know he was in the red zone for multiple games, to use the quotes by journalist Bobby Manzi, who's a frequent guest on this podcast. But I understand when you're a manager in Glasner's position, you're under a bit of pressure, you need results, not wanting to throw kids off into the deep end. But if you've spent so much time talking about the fact that you trust in them and that, you know, this is a multi-million pound academy, you trust in them, you want them to play, is it not hypocritical to not give them that time when it's obvious other players need a rest and we need something different? I know they may not have that quality, but given our lack of resources, what can you really do? Surely at a certain point, he just needs to take that plunge and back up his words.
Yeah, I think this is all the idealistic long-term vision of what Steve Parrish wants to do as a club. And I'm not saying that to put him down or to say that I disagree with it, but he clearly wants us to become even more self-sustainable than we are now. And he's done a great job doing that so far. That can't be said enough. You know, he really has. And to do that, he wants to expand the stadium. He wants to renovate and modernize the ground, sell more tickets, be able to make more revenue from that. Well, that money has to be spent, and that money can't be spent on transfers as much as we'd probably want it to. So where do you get these players from? You get them from the academy. That's what the goal of this Division One or Division One academy is. That's what the goal of all of this has been. It's been to make us more self-sustainable by creating players, developing from within, and not only spending less, but also making money from these potential player sales. I don't think that Glasner agrees that these players are ready yet. Because, like you said, if they were, I think we'd start to see them. And I think there's maybe a disconnect between the manager and the chairman in terms of if they're ready to go right now. And I think that Glasner's just doing a good job kind of being a nice servant to the club and not trying to make a public spat and say that he needed more players. I mean, he has slipped up a little bit every now and then and said that he would like to get some players earlier. And there's some times where he kind of gets a little bit candid and can't really hold back anymore. But all in all, I think he's been a very respectful manager in terms of his relationship with his chairman and his director of football. And I think that is the disconnect that we have. And you're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at any of these 3-4-3 systems, you know, if you look at the way Tuchel was when he was in his heyday, or Conte, or any of these guys, the reliance on the wingbacks is so big. And it's not necessarily to create. I see a lot of people talking online how these guys need to be these creative wizards. They really don't. The way I look at our wingbacks is they're our box-to-box midfielders of the club. They're the engines. They're moving back and forth, up and down. If James McArthur was 28 years old, he would probably be playing at right wing back for us right now. And I think he'd do a pretty good job because he had that engine and he was able to win the balls that were needed to be won. He was able to progress the ball forward. But I think that's the style of player that we need. Sure, we need him to fire some crosses in because they are wing backs, and that is an aspect of this system. But the requirement is really more on getting up and down the pitch. And to ask these two guys to do it for 38 matches in a season is just not fair. So it comes down to here we are. It's November. Whether we wait till January and see if we can add some depth there, or we use these 2 months and try to develop these guys a little bit at a time. Glasner alluded to Wolves not being the type of match to bring in those young players. So maybe he's waiting for, you know, us to be up one goal, two goals. God forbid that ever happens this season. I would love it. But maybe he's just waiting for a little bit less of a pressure cooker situation before he tries to blood these young guys. But right now, I just don't think that he feels they're ready yet, and that's where the disconnect comes from.
And I think Glasner's done a really good job of working with them behind the scenes. This is something that doesn't get as much media attention, obviously. But you know, you've got Franco Umeh, Caleb Cuppora, Justin Devenny, Ashraq Benone, all involved regularly in first team training this season. Hayden Rodney and Mofy Gemini have also been involved. Jesse Derry. He is giving them opportunities behind the scenes. They are developing as individuals and within the team. We just haven't seen it yet. What bothers me is the trade-off. Glasner said that it was intentionally. Now, this could obviously be part of the plan, or rather part of the sort of agreed justification for a lack of transfers to make the club look better. But Glasner's come out and said that it was part of the plan not to sign as many players and keep the squad small so that there would be chances for youth players, right? So that does indicate faith. We haven't seen as much of it yet. Maybe it's early on. Maybe it hasn't been the right circumstances due to the way results have been going, like you say. The main downside, really, for them is a lack of playtime in actual games. Because in being included with our squads and being relied on due to the lack of numbers we have with the injuries we have, they aren't actually playing for the under 21s. So Asha Agbenone hasn't actually played a game of football of more than 8 minutes than we saw in his cameo against Nottingham Forest for a month. Right? This is our, on paper, one of our most promising youth players. Franco Umeh, same thing, hasn't played for a month. Caleb Cuppora hasn't played for 3 weeks. Justin Devenny more recently, but missed the last game, maybe last two games. Now, the 21s have a game in the EFL Trophy in midweek. I assume that we'll see those players feature because we don't play until Saturday and a midweek game is fine. So that's tomorrow, Tuesday. It might be today when, at the time you're listening to this podcast. So that will be a chance to see those players against professional opposition. Typically in the EFL Trophy, sides tend to rotate. So League One or League Two, they'll play kind of their B team and throw in some youth prospects as well. So you'd hope that they'd come out on top. We did last time against Gillingham in a really good performance where Asher was fantastic. Ume was fantastic. Caleb Cupora was fantastic. But my point is it worth having that smaller squad size to account for youth development if they're not playing in the 21s and also not playing in the first team?
So I got to give you two answers with that. The first is for all the people that are wishing that we had Jesuwin Rexaki and David Ozoo back at the squad with our first team, despite Ozoo's injury. Let's just, that these things happen. It's still better that they're at Derby and Sheffield United respectively, because they are still getting a lot of first team minutes. And you can argue that Jez maybe isn't playing in the system that he's best to thrive in, but you know what? He's still playing 60 to 90 minutes on a weekend. Ozoo was one of Derby's best players for the first month of the season before he got hurt. So where it is a little bit detrimental to these guys that they're not getting these playing time, I don't wish, even in a crisis that we're in, I don't wish that we had Ozoo back. I don't wish that we had Jez back, because I think they're in a better situation right now to develop and contribute to us at a future date. The other thing is it depends on, with our guys that are staying back right now, these young kids that aren't getting the time with the U21s and they're up for training with the first team, it depends on what they're doing with that training. How intense is that training? Are they putting everything they have into it? Are they really gluing themselves to Glasner and leeching on to every word that he's saying? Are they getting in the ear of the senior player that plays in the same position as them, and just taking to what they're doing, watching how they go about their day, watching how they prepare, how they work, how they recover? Because that can cancel out a lot of the lack of playing time. It really can, because you're developing a habit, you're developing a routine, and you're seeing what it is to be a pro. And then if you are pushing yourself on the pitch and really playing at a high intensity, because let's face it, they probably know they're not going to play that much on the weekend anyway. So why not, rev it up all the way high intensity and really give it a go? If they're doing that, we can really mitigate a lot of the shortcomings that are coming from lack of actually getting match minutes. Now, of course, the caveat there is that there's really no replacement for match time, because that uncertainty, that unpredictability, being able to kind of see something and react to it on a quick basis, that doesn't happen in training as much. But that being said, I do think that there's a lot more pros than cons with them being up with the first team right now.
So moving back to the issues we have in midfield at the moment, obviously we've got a couple of injuries to Jefferson Lerma, who's out until after the international break. Adam Wharton's had his surgery and will be out for another month, so probably the week after the international break. And that leaves us with three fit players, first team players, capable of playing in central midfield, being Will Hughes, Daichi Kamada, and Cheick Doucouré returning from injury. Pat, what are your thoughts on sort of how we should line up in midfield ahead of Fulham, and who sort of justifies a start the most?
I think we need to be cautious with Doucouré. If he's ready for a full 90, then so be it. But I would find it hard to believe that he's ready to go a full 90 in a Premier League match right away. I think there is something to be said that perhaps we waited on Wharton's surgery until we had a fit Doucouré, so we weren't out both of them. I think the dots connect a little bit there, and where there's smoke, there's usually fire. So that could be a reason that we tried to hold off on that surgery for so long. I would start Kamada and Hughes, or start Doucouré, but have a minutes plan for him, 45 to 60 minutes, and see where he's at. I think the last thing we need right now is for him to go back down and re-injure himself again, and we'll really be left with the cupboard bare. So however we do it, whether we want to bring him on or whether we want to start him with a minutes limit, I would start him. But I would start Will Hughes next to him. I think Will Hughes has been a revelation for us this season. He's always shown glimpses of what he can do for us when played in the right position, and I think he's really having his strengths utilized and played toward right now. And in a season where we've had a lot of injuries and a lot of players not playing up to the expectations that we thought they should, I think Will Hughes has been a shining light for us. I think he's been every bit of the player that we could have asked him to be, and maybe even a little bit more. So I'm very happy with the way he's playing. I think I would have him with Doucouré, and then Kamada with Doucouré would probably be my swap.
Is there any justification for moving Kamada higher up the pitch to play on the left side at 10 with Eze's absence?
I would love to see it. I think the issue is just you're leaving yourself bare in that midfield. But if we do something where he starts for the first half in that left-sided 10 and then drops down into the midfield when we need to take Doucouré out, you are asking a little bit on the player to have that kind of dual role that isn't as easy as it is in playing Football Manager or FIFA career mode and just dropping a guy into a different position. There's a lot of tactical notes that he has to master in both positions for him to do that. And going back to that Villa match when he did struggle in the first half and came into his own in the second, I think part of it was because he was thrown into play in that 10 spot and then 15 minutes later was totally had to go play deeper. And it took him a little bit to kind of adjust to playing that new role. So that would be the caveat there is having him play in those two roles in one match would be tough, but I'd love to see him in that left side of 10. That's where he thrived the most in Glasner's system at Frankfurt. That's where we've never really had a chance to see him play because Eze's always been available for us. So I'd love to see that there, but the issue would be, can he play those two roles? And if not, who would be the one to come in for Doucouré? And you can tell me if it's something from the academy that we could have, or if, Lerma's going back quicker than expected, which I don't think is the case.
No, unfortunately, Jefferson Lerma won't be back for a bit longer. And in terms of academy players, Caden Rodney is injured, and Justin Devenny is the most likely candidate there, but he's unlikely to play. He does, of the current crop of under 21s at the club, have the most like senior experience. He's got over 30, 40 appearances in various leagues at a national level. Just obviously a much lower sort of quality of football than the Premier League, but he's done very well in the under 21s, and Glasner's been impressed with him. But I wouldn't dream of throwing him into the Premier League. I just don't think that's his level yet.
This is one potentially out of left field, but it's a player I've always rated, and it's too late now. The deal's been done, but man, I wish we didn't let Malachi Boateng go up to Hearts. I think he's always been a player that I've been a really big fan of. He was playing with the U21s, U23s when he was 18 years old. He was actually the player of the season for them, and he's always shown signs, always shown promise, and he's playing in a, the Scottish Premiership isn't great, but it's a very physical league, and he's holding his own. He's starting damn near every match for Hearts, and Hearts are a European candidate up there. So he's one that I think might have gotten away from us. We didn't sell him for that much money at all, so I just think we could have held on to him, and he could have been somebody that we could have thrown on right now, and I think I'd be okay with him. So maybe a little bit out of left field, but he is always somebody, if you know me, somebody I've really rated for a few years now.
Yeah, I think with Malachi, it was one of those things where he wanted to move on, and just have a team that was his. He'd been kind of loaned out a couple of times by us, just constantly getting sent back up to Scotland. And he was at that point in his career where he just needed to move on. We had David Ozo, quite a few years younger than him and arguably at a similar level. Certainly getting more attention from the academy. So yeah, obviously it'd be nice to have that kind of depth. Unfortunately, it wasn't quite right, just like time-wise with the club. But I'm not going to sort of disagree with you that it would be, plausible for him if he was still at the club to be filling in right now. Unfortunately, our 21s don't really have many players in that sort of central midfield role, which might be one of the benefits actually of us switching to that 5-2-3, at least at that sort of academy level. Because Justin Devenny is obviously coming and he's been fantastic in midfield, but that second role of the person next to him has been kind of confusing. Hindelo Mustafa was playing there in preseason, but it's just not his position. He's much more of a 10. Dylan Reid picked up an injury early on in the season. Caden Rodney's injured now, and he's strange in that he's good as a right back, a right centre back, a CDM, and no one really knows his true position. And that's actually one of the reasons he struggled to sort of break out of the academy and find himself alone. Jack Wells-Morrison's gone to Wealdstone. Ozo's gone to Derby County. So, yeah, we're kind of lacking in terms of academy midfield players, unfortunately. One thing I was noticing when you were talking was that, by the sounds of it, your lineup for Fulham would basically be the same side that started against Wolves, provided that Doucouré is not quite ready to start yet. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a lesser of all evils. Like I said, we talked about, I think Nketiah is out of position up there, and I think Kamada would have been a better fit, but If Zakori is not ready to go, I don't see how else you could line him up. I mean, could Schlupp play in that middle too?
Please don't.
And Glasner agrees with you too, because ever since he's arrived, he's never played anything but in that attacking three. So just really going off the top of my head, there's really no one else that can play there. So it the options would be Kamada or an academy player if Decore is not ready. So it almost lineup almost sets itself.
Yeah, I think obviously I'm a huge fan of Ashraq Benoni as a player in our academy. I think he's a really exciting talent. I think the fact he's so good on the ball means in possession he's well adapted for the Premier League. I think he'd probably struggle with end product immediately because he's not been the most clinical player. That's not to say he isn't a good finisher. He's a great finisher. But that's more technical than it is kind of end product, if you know what I'm trying to imply there. Like his technique is good a lot of the time, and he definitely finds the goal, but it tends to take him 3 or 4 attempts, and he gets that many attempts at under 21, under 18 level. He won't get it in the Premier League. Is his pace and trickery an asset? Yes. Is it probably more than anybody else currently fit at our club? Honestly, probably yes. I don't think I've seen Ismaila Sarr take on a man very well. He seems to just sort of run in a line and then run right around the outside and shoot low. He's not very imaginative as a player. I think Asher brings that. I'm obviously not making the case to start Ashraq Benoni against Fulham, but I'd like to see him get minutes because he does provide something really, really different. And the game's at Selhurst, right? So with the crowd behind him, a youth player can achieve anything if the team's in the right mood. So I'd like to see him potentially play. Then there's Daichi Kamada. I want to kind of zoom out and just look at Daichi Kamada's time at Palace so far, because I've been one of his harsher critics, solely because of the reputation he arrived with as a European winner, as Glasner's star boy, as a player of not world-class quality, obviously, but of a refined sort of breed of player. He looked good in pre-season. We hoped he'd be able to at least somewhat fill Elise's boots, but I wouldn't say he's even stepped into one of them, given the fact that he's been beyond disappointing in that role and has played predominantly through necessity or through performance at centre mid rather than cam. He's not lived up to the hype, to put it plainly, in my view. I'd like to hear what you have sort of on the contrary, what your views are on him as a player at Palace rather than just as a player in general, because he's a Crystal Palace player and that's the situation.
Yeah, I still think that we would think more of him, and he would be much more in the supporters' favor if he played in the position that he played most of the time with Glasner, especially in those first 2 seasons. The first season, I should say. He had, and you said he had a great preseason with us. He absolutely did. But did he ever play in the midfield duo in the preseason? No, he did not. He played as a number 10 almost exclusively, and he looked good doing it against Nantes in our last preseason friendly. He was the one that scored the goal for us in that position, that right-sided 10 role. So he played there against Brentford, and he wasn't the reason we lost to Brentford. We lost to Brentford because we were just picked to death on the counter. And Eze's goal got disallowed, but we're not going to reopen old wounds there. And then he played there for Chelsea at Stamford Bridge for a half, and he looked good there too. And we got a really impressive draw away from home at a Chelsea side that's been quite good this year. So those are really the only 2 times that he's got exclusive minutes there while planning on playing there, not coming off the bench as a shock or anything like that. And I would say he did pretty well. I mean, he's learning a new position, not entirely new for him, because if you go back to his time at Frankfurt, he did play there from time to time. And at Lazio last year, he did play in that same kind of number eight, number six, whatever you want to call it, role from time to time. But he's learning a new system whether he's been in that system before. Glasner's system has evolved in the past 4 years. You know, everybody's system evolves. It's similar. It's very similar, but there's nuances that change. And he's in a new league. So for him to be doing both of those things at the same time, there was of course going to be a learning curve, and he just needs to be a little more consistent. It's funny, the first half against Villa, we kind of discussed why he struggled a little bit, changing positions, coming off the bench. He didn't look great. The second half, obviously, scores the game winner, and he was just very good. His positioning isn't the best, but it was better. He was winning a lot of duels. He was winning a lot of tackles. He was playing a lot more balls forward than he normally does, and he got that goal. He kind of continued that in this first half against Wolves, and then the second half was almost the opposite of what happened against Villa. The second half, he looked a little bit off the pace. He looked a little complacent. I mean, again, is he getting fatigued? I would guess not, because he's had more time to rest than most of our other regulars. But that second half against Wolves, he didn't look good. It was hard to defend him in a lot of times. He certainly wasn't the sole perpetrator of their second goal, but he was certainly involved in why they got the ball down the pitch in that position to score. So he just needs to be consistent. And I think, as we alluded to earlier, and as I spoke on, it is really hard to learn two different positions and be expected to go in and play either of them. So I think the old adage, being a jack of all trades but a master of one, comes into play with Daichi Kamada right now, where I would love for him to just have a role, stick to that role, and kind of sharpen that knife in that role that he's playing and that he's been chosen for. But until then, I think we're not going to see the consistent levels that we want. And I do think, I don't know why, but I do think it has been a little personal against him. I don't know the reason. I'm not going to be some philosopher and unpack that. But Palace loves the scapegoat. We always have. You can go back in the years, and sometimes it's even been players like Ivari Eze and Michael Olise. So we're not discriminate in who we kind of give that scapegoat role to sometimes. But I think Kamada's been the guy lately, and hopefully that if we see an improvement in Kamada's play, that doesn't get shifted to Eddie Nketiah, which the murmurs are kind of happening a little bit already. But I do think it's been a little personal. I do think that if you watch one player and pick him apart, you're going to find a fault with something that he did. And I hope that we can just support him and see that he's extremely passionate. He's extremely hardworking. He wants to improve. And as you said, we're playing Fulham at home. We need that home support to back him if he does play, and not just let this thing snowball, because he's shown glimpses of being able to pull himself out of this rut, shown glimpses of consistency. And I think he just needs our backing to get fully over that line.
I think it might be a, and this isn't to sort of justify the more personal, harsh criticism he's received. It might be related to the money involved, because as a club that doesn't spend much money, when we do, we have seen a lot of disappointment, weirdly enough, over the years. You know, Mamadou Sakho and Christian Benteke, two of our biggest signings, didn't really live up to the hype that brought them in. Eddie Nketiah has been signed for, you know, a huge fee for what we typically spend after 3 years of Dougie Friedman basically sort of being in love with him, right? Nketiah hasn't lived up to that hype yet. I genuinely do believe in him, as I do in Daichi Kamada. The difference is Daichi Kamada was meant to be an instant fit in the Glasner setup due to their previous experience together, and he's currently the highest paid footballer at the club. That would probably be, if I were to philosophize, one of the driving factors behind the criticism. It's also the fact that he's a very lightweight player. He constantly ends up in positions where he's not quick enough to make a recovery tackle. So he tries to take someone down, and then he doesn't take someone down. He ends up throwing himself at them, not having the energy or strength or power to bring them down, and ends up sitting on the floor whilst the player runs on ahead and starts a counter. It happened with Wan-Bissaka against West Ham early in the season, and he was blamed for that. It happened against Wolves multiple times. It happened against Everton multiple times. Even happened against Villa a couple of times. He's a very lightweight player. You know, he's good in the sort of pressing tackle, but in the recovery tackle, he's a very weak player. It's probably a symptom of him not having made many tackles like that before. He won't have experience as much as he isn't a natural sort of deeper centre mid, which is typically the role that's required to make those kind of tackles. Doucouré is a master of them, for example, or at least a fully fit Doucouré is. I don't want to criticise him for, those traits that aren't natural to him. He is, performing worse because of the role he's being asked to play in. But at the same time, he did play there for a long period of time on under Glasner at Frankfurt. And that kind of takes me to this general Bundesliga idea of when players move from the Bundesliga to the Premier League, if they're more lightweight, so not the Haalands of the world or the Akanjis of the world, there is a physical step up. And we see players like Timo Werner or in this case, Daichi Kamada look especially lightweight, more with their first touch, and almost kind of unagile in a really strange way. Like Kamada is typically a close dribbler. We haven't seen a shade of that since he's moved here. He hasn't taken a player on. He hasn't really been turning or showing flair on the ball beyond the odd first time flick, which hasn't paid off because Mateta hasn't had the fitness or awareness to clock onto it, right? So I don't know if there's like an evidence thing or if you're an expert on Bundesliga football, particularly relative to things. I'm certainly not. I've just noticed this kind of pattern that Daichi Kamada seems to fit the profile of.
Yeah, I mean, Bundesliga in general is a very transition-based game, right? So it's not really about hunkering down and defending. It's about counter-pressing. And counter-pressing is a lot different than being in position to make a tackle. And that's where I'll knock back on the lightweight stuff. I don't think he's a lightweight player. I think his positioning is poor and he's a little late to make a challenge and maybe making the wrong angle because he's not a natural central midfielder. He did play there under Glasner, but it's important to note that the reason he played there under Glasner is because Frankfurt signed Mario Götze, and Mario Götze was, of course, going to play in that attacking midfield role as he always did. So he was being forced to adapt and be a kind of square peg in a round hole even at Frankfurt under Glasner. So it's not the first time Glasner's kind of pigeonholed him a little bit. And you could say his success was great, not great, average in that time in the Bundesliga also. But I wouldn't call Michael Olyse a lightweight player. He's the exact same size as Daichi Kamada. They're both 6 foot, about 165 pounds. They're not small players. They play with the physicality when needed, but positionally, I'm just knocking back on the stature thing. Positionally, I 100% agree. I think he's just too slow to challenges. I think he's not setting himself up to win the ball back quick enough. And being deeper in that role, I think it's harder to dribble when you're deeper in those roles because it is a little bit more risky. If you're going to try and take a man on when you're playing in that kind of sixth spot, you lose the ball there. You're putting your back three in a really tough situation. If you're losing the ball when you're up in the front, which is where he's a little more natural, then it's not as bad. So I think he's a little risk averse right now in terms of trying to take players on. And I mean, the guy's not a dumb person. He doesn't live with blinders. I'm sure he knows that when he's out there, if he makes a big mistake, he's going to hear it. And he probably is living with a little bit of kind of fear of making a mistake right now, which is why that second half in Villa was so important for him. But yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for it. And, we can talk about the player wages, which I think is a good point. But let's not forget he came on a free transfer. So how player amortization works is you roll in the transfer fee of what you paid for a player over the course of their contract. So because he didn't sign for any amount of money, he is able to get a higher bit of wage and it doesn't really cost the club as much. So if he's making 100,000, I'm just making a number up, and he didn't sign for any fee at all, it's costing the club about the same as if we signed somebody for 75,000 a week and we paid, 7 to 10 million for it. So you gotta remember that too. And yeah, if you're getting paid a lot of wages, regardless of if there was a transfer fee or not, you do have an expectation. But I think he'd be a little more plug and play if he played in that higher up the pitch role. That's what we all expected him to play. So I just think there's a lot of reasons why it's not clicking, but one of them is not effort, and one of them is not a lack of working hard and being complacent. He's certainly not that. So I do think he's going to figure it out. He seems like the type of player that kind of prides himself on getting the little things right and improving as he goes along. So I still have faith that he'll come around.
Yeah, I mean, you say we sort of all expected him to play in that front kind of three. We also all expected us to sign another Michael Olise replacement. So
We sure did.
here we are. It's honestly unfortunate that for however many a season, we're watching players suffer for the lack of inaction at the club. In the same way that we're also seeing players suffer for the money and situation in which they were brought in. I think Kamada wouldn't be being criticized if he were a rotation player and we'd signed an Olise replacement who was starting. In the same way, I don't think that Dean Henderson would get the criticism he gets if we hadn't signed him in the context in which we'd signed him, being we have Sam Johnson at the time and we needed to sign other players with the money that we had at our disposal in that summer window. Because if you look at the players that we've kind of signed recently from the bigger teams, right? So signing from Frankfurt, we signed Daichi Kamada. We bought Dean Henderson from Manchester United, Eddie Nketiah from Arsenal, Rob Holding from Arsenal. Those transfers haven't really clicked so far. I'd say Dean Henderson's been brilliant this season. I'd argue he's been one of our players of the season alongside Will Hughes and Jefferson Lerma. But in many people's eyes, for whatever reason, Dean Henderson hasn't really earned the confidence yet. I'm personally a huge disbeliever of that take. But I wouldn't be surprised if the finances, regardless of the reality of them, do play a role in the way that we, as a fan base, view the success of those players' performances. It's a sort of old, I'd argue, kind of an English cultural cynicism as well. There's a scene in The Big Short, I don't know if you've seen that film, where Brad Pitt's character is trading a ridiculous amount of money in a pub, and there's a sort of an old bloke behind him taking the piss. That's kind of the attitude that gets brought to players that are being signed and paid the kind of money that exists in the Premier League. I'm not here to propose a solution to it. I'm just saying that it's a part of the sort of cultural discussion on these players' ability, quality, and performances. If we're looking to shift away from sort of first team discussions and look maybe club wide, I just want to highlight a player that's going to be playing Tuesday night for the 21s, which is Jamaya Omolu. Signed for us after a prolonged trial period from West Ham last season, playing for the under 18s and then the under 21s, and actually featured towards the end of the season in the PL International Cup games for the 21s. He is a true number nine. He is a remarkably physical player for the 18, 19-year-old that he is. He's stepped into the 21s and is looking much more assured as a target man than Ademola Oladipo did as a 20, 21-year-old. Obviously, he's currently not doing so great on his loan in Belgium, but Amulu looks much more well-rounded. He is tall, strong, good passer, excellent finisher. He reminds me, honestly, quite a lot of Mateta if Mateta was left-footed. He's a bit more, I'd say, he's less flamboyant than Mateta, let's say that. He's sort of a true number nine in that sense without wanting to go too cliche. He holds up the ball well. He comes deep. He scores with his left foot. He's really quite an adept technical finisher. He doesn't scuff many shots. He has a lot of shot power on him. And he's our top goal scorer this season with some pretty impressive numbers in the amount of games that he's played. It's kind of interesting because he's clearly preferred as a number nine. And Zach Marsh, who was scoring so freely at under 18 level last season, has been kind of deployed more as a 10. Partly because Ashraf Benoni hasn't been available to play in that role because he's been up with the first team. So we've seen Zach Marsh and Hindola Mustafa kind of behind Jamaya Omolu. But what Omolu brings to the EFL Trophy games against sort of professional footballers rather than academy kids is that physicality. And that's what makes him stand out. And it's kind of exciting because you don't get many players at his age who are scoring and the physical package. You know, in our academy, we've got players like Mofi Djemedi and Hindola Mustafa who are physically ahead of their years. But they struggle in other areas. For example, Mustafa's first touch is woeful at times. His weight of pass is not consistent at all, and he's got to iron that out. Otherwise, he's a pretty exciting player. Mo Fujimori, same kind of thing. His jockeying can be a bit misjudged at times, even though he's playing sort of an age group up than what we'd otherwise expect, and that's exciting for him. Omolu knows his body quite well. The only time we see him struggle is against players that are seasoned professionals, at least physically. So that's quite exciting. I've been really cautious about getting on the bandwagon about him because strikers that perform well at 18, 21 level typically don't necessarily always translate to the first team. We haven't had a striker come through our academy for a very, very long time. So I don't want to kind of build up too much pressure on the guy. I don't know how much of him you've watched either, but I've gone from being sort of skeptical of him at the start of the season to believing he might have a pretty high ceiling.
Yeah, there's that catch 22 at the academy level because the number one thing that really halts these guys' progress from making that step to the first team is the physical nature of the senior game at the Premier League level, at the championship level, at you know, any level there. And you know, you look at the difference between a David Ozo and a Naya Kirby. You know, shout out to Naya Kirby, that's my guy. I'm still sad that he didn't make it for us. But you know, Ozo has those physical traits. But then the other side of that coin that makes it kind of this like catch 22 is, as you said, if you do develop too physically too early, you won't develop all the technical sides because you'll just get away with it. You know, so you talk about these strikers that dominate at, you know, 18 year, 21 year, all those levels, and they don't really make that jump. And it's because when you're this big, tall, strong player compared to who you're playing against, you don't need to develop a weaker foot. You don't need to develop kind of off ball movements. You don't need to develop shot placement. So it takes that kind of perfect, you know, I'm developing my physicality at the same time as I'm developing my technical quality. And that's why I'm so excited about our young striker here, because he seems to have both. And that is where you can start to really flourish as you jump up. Now, the big caveat is, of course, the level between the Premier League and the academy is just a gulf, a massive gulf, a rift. So it is good to see that he's playing in the, you know, EFL Trophy against some true senior players. And it is good that he isn't expected to come up and do anything for us right now. We have Mateta, and you know, despite what Glasner has been playing him at, and Nketiah is a striker, so we don't have that need for him to step up and play, so he can develop at his own time. And you know, I think that's good. But as we talked about, eventually that's what we're going to have come to fruition, is these players are going to have to come up, and the first crop of kids that make that jump, they're kind of going to be the sacrificial lambs in a bit of a sense, because they might not be fully ready. They might have to kind of take the lumps for the next crew of kids to get on, because eventually we're trying to turn that into a conveyor belt of Premier League players. And hopefully it starts sooner than later, but I think we just need to be patient. And yeah, we just need to be patient. Well, I think we'll leave it there. That's all the time we're going to have. And as always, Bruno, I thank you for your time. Nice, just a one-on-one chat with you tonight.
Yeah, honestly, it was really nice to kind of have a more mellow discussion about things on a kind of case-by-case basis. Let us know if you want to see more of this kind of format, guys, as well, because we typically have like two other people on, but I think there is merit in a sort of more limited discussion at the same time.
Yeah, and you know, as always, just continue to support the club. I think as we said, the draw was a little unfortunate. We talked about that in the beginning, but I'm taking 4 points against Spurs and Wolves all day. I know that most people are also. And you know, we get a nice result against Fulham here. If we continue what we're doing, if we continue to play the way we're playing, we're gonna have a result at home, whether it's a draw or whether it's three. I am confident that we do seem to be back on track. So I'm confident. I hope you guys are confident. As always, go ahead and follow the Palace Way on socials, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. Hopefully we have a TikTok. Do we have a TikTok? Okay. Instagram, Twitter, TikTok at the Palace Way. Go ahead and read the articles. Bruno and our writers are excellent at giving you in details about the next players that are coming up from the academy. I certainly learn a lot as someone that can't really watch as much academy as I'd like to. I learn a lot from their articles, so I'd advise you to do the same if you have any interest in who the next big name is, who maybe the next David Ozo is, or maybe you want to know more about Asher Agbenoni. So go ahead and check out the site there and educate yourself. As always, I am Pat, and I'll throw it over to Bruno. Bruno, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me, man. Or rather, thanks for tuning in, guys. I mean, it's kind of a two-man show here. Pat has come in this season, done an absolutely fantastic job. So show some love on the ratings. Let us know what you think. We're always happy to hear constructive criticism, just good things, just bad things as well. Just let us know.
As always, thanks for your time. Up the Palace.